Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 119 of the Video Game History Hour, the official podcast of the Video Game History Foundation. I'm your host, Frank Cifaldi, and on today's show, we'll be talking about the making of Karateka, in both senses, I guess, of the phrase, meaning the recent Digital Eclipse published interactive documentary titled The Making of Karateka, and, you know, the actual making of the original Karateka. Here with me are two very special guests returning to the show once again is Chris Kohler. How you doing, Chris?
Hello, Frank. Great.
And then the actual creator of Karateka is with us as well, Jordan Mechner. Welcome to the Video Game History Hour.
Hi, guys. Frank, you've done 119 of these?
I have.
Wow. Well, it's my very first.
Yeah, that's right. So the percentage of Jordan Mechner episodes is still quite low. I believe this is Chris Kohler's fourth episode.
Oh, my gosh. Mistaken.
Yeah. So we'll have to get you on as an expert guest for something else. Maybe the making of Prince of Persia. Come on. Like, that's the next product, right, Chris? Like, you already got that lined up. We're ready to go.
Oh, yeah. It's locked. No. Come on. What are you trying to do to me here?
So I very much know the answer to this question, but I'm just going to open it up to the room, to the two of you. What is the making of Karateka, as in the product?
Oh, sure. The Making of Karateka is an interactive documentary produced by us here at Digital Eclipse in partnership with Jordan. It's not a retro game collection. You know, it is very much, it uses Jordan's original games, but also Jordan's original design documents and the journals that he wrote when he was a teenager making this game, the contents of his floppy disks that we dug into, and literally every other piece of historical, information or artifacts that we could find to present to you in an interactive way, a true documentary of the story of how Jordan got started in the video game industry, and then also how the process by which Karateka, this landmark game, was created.
And then, Jordan, I'll kick it to you. What is Karateka?
Well, Karateka is, or Karateka, after 40 years, I still can't decide how to pronounce it. This is the first game that I made that got published. I was in college, and I'd been, since I was in high school, I had my Apple II computer, and I was, learning how to program and making game after game. Karateka is a side-scrolling, punching, kicking, inspired by Japanese samurai movies and Bruce Lee movies. It's a sort of a historical adventure where all you're doing is punching and kicking. It's set in medieval Japan. And it was published by Broderbund in 1984, and that's what launched my video game making career.
So we started talking about this before the show, but then I was like, no, let's just hit record before I do this. This is kind of an interesting dynamic because technically I worked on this product. The making of Karateka at Digital Eclipse goes back to when I had Chris's job at Digital Eclipse. and so in the very earliest days, I did some sort of conceptual work and things like that, and like organizing of the strong assets some design ideas and stuff. I even helped present it to you at one point, Jordan, like a build of it.
For a second, when you said that, I thought you meant you'd worked on Karateka. And no. I was like, wait, you must have been two.
Yeah. I ported it to IBM, right? No. I worked on the Digital Eclipse product. The question I basically have at this point is, how did this project come together? So now, Digital Eclipse, if you don't mind me editorializing a little bit, Chris, getting my DE pants back on.
I think that you, if you want to talk about the origins of this project, are the best person to talk about it, probably.
Sure. Okay. So Digital Eclipse, I think Chris and I, both very on brand, were very careful already in the couple minutes of this podcast to call this product an interactive documentary. So Digital Eclipse, the modern incarnation of it, is a game developer and now publisher, that focuses on, contextualizing video game history in an interactive way. So I'm kind of speaking from the past, but I think all this applies. So jump in if company ethos has changed at all. But
sure.
So the thinking behind Digital Eclipse is that the idea of just sort of like a retro game compilation is, well, first of all, kind of boring, you know, just like having a value pack of old games without context. But second of all, I think does a disservice to classic video games in that it relegates the audience only to those who are already familiar with the source material. We wanted to create a world, Digital Eclipse wants to create a world where classic titles can be recontextualized so that a new audience can understand them and, you know, an existing audience can maybe understand them on a deeper level. And Karateka's, you know, the latest product, there's been many. I mean, the ones I worked on were Mega Man Legacy Collection, SNK 40th, but there was a Street Fighter one. Chris, you just shipped Atari 50 before this. There's been a handful of these. And the making of Karateka is, in many ways, like the dream I always had, which was, what if I only had to talk about one game, you know, as opposed to like the 30 that I've had to do in the past.
Right.
So, Jordan, from your perspective on it, actually, like, how did this product come together? Were you approached asking for the rights to Karateka? Or I actually don't have that much insight into this.
Well, I mean, it was a few years ago. When this was first presented to me, the pitch was basically re-release Karateka and give it the Criterion Collection treatment. That is all of the versions, you know, remastered and with some sort of supporting documentation, kind of a making of. And I said, yes, great. I didn't imagine what this was going to be. I couldn't have envisioned it. And when I saw the when Chris came and showed me the first work in progress version in New York a few months ago, I was really blown away by just the depth of what they did. You could say that it's a deep dive. I don't think any description could do justice to, you know, what I felt when I saw it. It's like, I felt like I was walking around in a museum that had somehow dedicated an entire wing to this one game, to Karateka. And it was, you know, and there are screens in which you could pick up the controller and play any version of the game, not just the published versions, but also the work in progress versions that I sent to Broderbund when I was trying to get the game published. Versions that I hadn't seen in 40 years that I just put on a floppy disk and stuck in a shoebox in a closet, never saw again. Somehow Digital Eclipse, you know, found that shoebox, which I'd given to the Strong Museum of Play, and figured out what the bits and bytes on it were and made it work again. So even the tools that I made and used to create Karateka back then are there. The sketches, the correspondence, you know, the letters that I had typed and put in an envelope and mailed to Doug Carlson at Broderbund discussing, and again, not just Karateka, but the games that I had made when I was a freshman in college, trying to get my very first game published, you know, so that making games could be a real career instead of just a hobby that was causing me to almost fail all of my classes.
Well, I mean, you bring that up, and I think it's worth maybe talking about Death Bounce for a minute here. So, go ahead, Jordan.
Yeah, Death Bounce is the game that I spent, you know, 6 months making before Karateka, and which I didn't quite make it over the bar to get published by Broderbund. So I was, you know, I had my hopes up and then I was crushed. And then I was like, all right, I'll go back to Death Bounce and add these features and make it better. And at a certain point, I got the idea for Karateka and started working on that. And so from like 1982 to 83, it was more and more I was working on Karateka, less and less Death Bounce, and even less than that working on my classes, which I had signed up to take and which I should have been working on. But all of that is in the making of Karateka. You can kind of track the timeline, and for everything that happened, there are the artifacts, there are the letters, there are the screenshots, there are the playable versions of these works in progress. So it's not just the making of Karateka, it's the making of and the remaking of Death Bounce.
Now, there have been some instances of previously unpublished video games coming out. You know, Star Fox 2 by Nintendo comes to mind. Chip's Challenge 2 was one that I don't hear people talk about too often, but you know, Chip's Challenge I think was a really cool game, and seeing its lost sequel come out of nowhere. But I don't think the period between creation and publishing, I think this is by far the record at what, like 42 years, something like that.
Yeah. I gave up, you know, I've sort of let go and moved on in 1983. So in terms of delayed gratification, yeah, it's certainly a record for me.
You know, like Chris, not to demean the work or anything, but you know, Jordan brings up, you know, all of this archival material and right. and how it was in a shoebox. I mean, in a lot of ways, Jordan made this really easy for you.
Jordan made it possible. Yeah. Jordan made it possible. I never call any part of this easy, but Jordan made it possible because, I mean, it goes back to what you were saying. Gee, I'd love to do this with one single game. It's hard to imagine another game in which we could do this. And, you know, Jordan, Jordan is saying like, you know, oh, they had all of these artifacts in there. It's right. Well, that was possible because Jordan, in a very sort of atypical fashion for a, you know, for a kid at college or really anybody doing video game development, you know, you kept a daily journal of everything that you did that day, including all of the work that you did on the games. And then you saved all your correspondence, not only the correspondence that came in, but you saved copies of the letters that you were sending out to people. You know, you were very business minded. You made sure you had all this full archive, which I'm sure helped you a lot later with, like, you know, contractual negotiations or needing to prove that, you know, something was in writing. But you saved all of this and you donated it to the Strong Museum, which is a great thing to do for papers like that. And then the floppy disk archives that, you know, it's funny because I had kind of said that, like, my involvement in all of this stretches back like over 10 years ago because at the time, your PR representative had gotten in touch with me at Wired to say, oh, some guys are going to digitize all of Jordan Mechner's floppy disks and they're looking for his Prince of Persia source code to try to retrieve it. Do you want to cover this? And I said, well, I can't get down to LA myself, but I have a writer in LA, Gus Mastrapa, so he should go down. So Gus Mastrapa goes down and he was the writer, the sole person in the room, the reporter covering what was going on.
I remember
that great
day.
Piece. Yeah. We sent a photographer down there as well. I mean, we really did the whole nine yards to cover this cool event. And the important thing is not only did you know, the archivists recover the Prince of Persia source code, which was in the closet in your father's apartment, right? Yes. That I had visited, that's where you found it. There's of course the hilarious story that when I was out at your father's apartment to show you the game, we opened up that closet again so you could show me the closet. And then within about 5 minutes of looking, you pulled out a second shoebox and that was full of all your cassette tape games.
Oh yeah. My sister pulled that out. And this is from high school. These are the cassette tapes of my first, basic and assembly language game. Somehow she had found it in our old house and pulled it out at that moment. Yeah. It's so lucky that you were there to take it. Take that.
Yeah, totally. Well, also, here I am in New York City and I'm in this apartment with you and your family. And it's just like, okay, well, Chris, you're the best person to take these. I'm like, oh no. So now I'm carrying this precious cargo back on the airplane. And now it's in the hands of the Video Game History Foundation. So hopefully if there is anything still on those cassettes, it'll be found.
And my sister is happy because one less object taking up space in the closet.
Exactly. And so it's a win-win for everybody. And so back to the archiving of your floppy disks originally 10 years ago, not only was the Prince of Persia source code found, but, you know, many, many other floppy disks were recovered that actually gave us all of the versions of Death Bounce, all of the prototype versions of Karateka. And then, I mean, there were just sort of source floppy disks that you were saving things to. And that gave us all kinds of, like, essentially fake screenshots that you were making as part of your design process, because part of the process was you wanted to get something up on screen that kind of looked like what the game was going to look like. And so we were able to take those and put it in. So, and the important thing is the journals, what I kind of realized coming in, like that original version of the game that existed.
Well, hang on. Let's pause for a second. For just 1 second and just, I want to reiterate the importance of this because I think we glossed over this.
Yeah.
Jordan also kept a daily journal, which he published an edited version of, which is crazy. Like, no one's done that before. Yeah.
Right. And so the journals allowed us to put it into a chronological timeline, because now we're just not, because in a retro game collection, right, which is the sort of, you know, like that's what an interactive documentary is trying not to be. You would have the games over here, and then what you would essentially have is like a museum, but the museum would be the museum in some of these collections is if you were to walk into a museum and they took everything out of the back room, they took all the dinosaur bones and they just put them in a pile on the floor. You know, like that's not helping anybody. You have to build a, you have to reconstruct the dinosaur, and then you have to put a little label next to it that says what kind of a dinosaur it is and give some information about it. And then in a broader context, that dinosaur can't just be plunked in the middle of all of the Da Vinci paintings either. Like it, there has to be a narrative as you walk through that museum. But then it also importantly, you can't control where the person walks in the museum. So no matter if they walk through it really quickly, or if they walk through it really slowly and read everything, or if they go backwards, they should be able to sort of piece together a narrative in their minds. And so that's top of mind for us when we're constructing this user-controllable interactive documentary. And so I guess the other point is that when I came in 2020, there was already a version of Karateka that was mostly kind of separated out in that way. Play the games over here. Here's a bunch of things you can look at. But it wasn't chronological. And there was this attempt to do this interactive documentary idea where it was like, watch a video clip and then a document will be put in front of you. And then you watch another video clip and then you see another document. And there was something to that. Like there was something there, but ultimately it was too constricting. And also when I started, because what Frank said to me was, don't look at this project as, you're like doing a copy edit pass on a finished project. Like if you want to go in there and change the whole thing, you can do that. And so I started
definitely not in control of the purse strings at Digital Eclipse.
Right.
Full permission to break down this product and rebuild.
Well, you know what? When you're coming in somewhere, the question is, it's like on those first few days, it's always like, you know, am I putting myself into a box, or, you know, am I saying like I'm being brought in to, you know, revitalize what we're doing, right? And so I read through the journals, and as I'm reading through the Karateka and the Prince of Persia journals, I'm just like, this leaps off the page, this character of this teenage Jordan Mechner. Like, I love this guy. This guy is so funny. He's got such teenage problems, and they're all right here. And you can see all of his issues with, you know, the struggle between, you know, wanting to make it big, hit it rich in the gaming industry, but also needing to go to class, and, you know, and it was a fascinating story. And it's like, there really is something here. We have to do the video game version of this, and we have to make it leap off the page in the same way. But we have the ability, as you're reading the book and you read about Jordan's first Death Bounce prototype, instead of just having Jordan describe this prototype, you know, you, the player, get to play the prototype. So we've got to lay it out in that way. And essentially then what kind of happens is, you know, and we keep having to stop working on Karateka for long stretches of time because major projects come in that kind of require all hands on deck, and they have very specific tight deadlines, whereas this is an independently produced project can, you know, it essentially fall by the wayside if somebody's not looking out for it, basically. So, you know, we always kept trying to make sure to come back to it. And then we were fortunate enough, you know, basically this year to be able to put a whole team on it, take it all the way to the finish line. But all the material was there for a while. And I even went back to the Strong and I said, hey, I have a sneaking, can you send me everything? Like, I have a sneaking suspicion that we don't have everything. And one of the things, I mean, there was all this like Karateka 2 information that was sort of buried in some of the scans that they had. And then all of the tracing paper from the first session with your karate teacher, your first rotoscoping session, was all misfiled as Prince of Persia. I was really glad that I did that, because a lot of stuff came out that was like, oh, this is actually this is necessary. Anyway, I've talked a lot.
Yeah, no, it's what you said. I mean, the first version was perfectly fine, and if that had been it, I would have said great. But what you've done is so much better than that. it's, I mean, when I keep thinking of a museum exhibit, it's because, I mean, that's what's great about a museum. You can walk around, you can walk through a room really fast, and then you can come back and look at stuff again. You know, and that little screen that had a button that you can press, you can put on headphones and, you know, watch a video about it, or you can pick up the controller and play it. All of that is just waiting if you want to do it, when you want to do it. But because everything is in context, it's like, I understand the story better now than even when I published my journals, The Making of Karateka, as a book, you know, reading it, I can kind of remember, but when I would write something like, oh, I finally got the letter from Broderbund, you know, I'm so disgruntled. I think I'm, you know, I would think, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what letter that was. Well, with yours, you can actually click and see, here's the letter. Mm-hmm. You can read what they wrote. You can read my response. And it really fleshes out the picture.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty remarkable being able to put all that stuff together. It's just, it's so funny, Chris, because like I'm reliving my own memories of the brief time I worked on this. And like when I was playing through the game, it's like, oh, I actually think Chris organized this basically the same way I did. Like, you know, I had, you know, my last folder was like Karateka Legacy, and I had one that was like early days in Death Bounce, and I had one that was like, you know, porting the game, you know, and it's like a very similar structure to what you had. But Jordan, I want to go back to your donation to the Strong, and maybe even before that, and kind of ask, because we talk a lot on the show about the importance of preserving development documentation and source code, and how fragile that material actually is. And I'm trying to frame this as a question. It's well, first of all, why did you save all that stuff? And second, like, were there circumstances that kept it around? Like, maybe, for example, your dad never left that apartment.
You know, it's interesting. I've been wondering about this, because at the time I just did it. You know, I was 17, 18, 19 years old. I started keeping a journal freshman year in college, and for some reason I just kept keeping it. And I never threw it out. Of course, I didn't think I was ever going to publish the journal. I didn't think anybody was ever even going to read it. I would have been mortified to think that someone other than me would see what I wrote in my journal. But, you know, time works miracles. But yeah, I kept it. And I also kept my work notes and all the floppy disks, instead of just recycling them. You know, a lot of times at the end of a project, you know, people just toss all of the paperwork because they don't need it anymore. The thing is done, move on. So I'm wondering, like, why didn't I toss it? Like, why did I cart all those notes? Like, why did I stick them in a folder, label the folder Karateka, cart it back from college to, you know, to home, and then cart it with me everywhere I moved after that, to the point where, you know, I was, as an adult in, you know, in LA, I had a garage with a couple of boxes of old papers, which contained my old game stuff that I was able to donate to the Strong. So why did I do that? I think now that it comes from the family, and it's funny, Chris, what you were saying before about how the fact that I kept all of this stuff, it made your job more difficult, but it made it possible. I've just spent 2.5 years writing and drawing a graphic novel that tells the story of not just my story making games, but three generations of my family. My grandfather as a soldier in World War I, when it was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, my dad as a child refugee during World War II. And I was able to reconstruct, you know, to draw these events that they lived through as a comic, partly because my grandfather collected all the photos, all the, you know, letters, documents he received from the new Nazi government telling him that he had to give up his medical practice. He actually kept all of those. Somehow, and even though as refugees they lost almost everything when they came from Europe to the U.S., the photographs and documents that they had, I think, were precious to them because it was because there were so few mementos of that vanished world that they had lost. I think somehow I must have absorbed that unconsciously, even though as a kid growing up in New York, you know, I had no such worries. I think the idea that letters and working notes might be precious to somebody like many years later, somehow I absorbed that. And And I've seen that with all, you know, all the stuff, you know, stuff from college and, you know, because for 10, 20 years, it was just old stuff that had no interest to anybody. But after 30 years, it starts to be interesting. And after 40 years, oh, it's gaming history. And so I think I'd seen that happen with my grandfather's old stuff from the 1900s, how few photos there were and how precious they were. But it's not that I thought that consciously or anything. I think it was just instinctive. Like I just, at some level, I felt like it would be, I couldn't throw out that folder full of notes because something said, no, that's, it's a shame to throw that out. Like that's years of work. Just stick it in the folder and put the folder in a box. And so that's how I got here.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, that's kind of where I was maybe going with this was wondering if it was a conscious act or if it was something subconscious. I mean, you use the word subconscious yourself and I almost wonder if it's, you know, important to kind of go down this route in this conversation, because I think we have a lot of, you know, younger creators listening to this show who might not necessarily, you know, have the foresight to understand that the work that they're creating is going to be important one day. And so I kind of want to explore this journey a little bit longer with you, Jordan. So for you, there was at least the sort of subconscious notion that documentation is important, but you didn't necessarily have it in mind that like gaming fans, fans of mine are going to want to see this, or that maybe even the work that you've done, you had done up to that point was historically important 40 years from now.
I mean, at the time, I didn't even know if I was ever going to have any fans or if these games were even going to be published.
Right.
So,
yeah. So, I mean, you know, the advice that that we often give to people not kind of understanding how to save their stuff. I mean, we took this from Lane Nooney, a historian who's been on the show in the past, which is just put your stuff in a box. Like that's still literally the advice that we give today, you know, even in a more digital world. It's like, well, then put it on a hard drive first and then put it in a box. And you know, so much of my job at the foundation is just finding the boxes that survived. And, you know, it's hard for people to sort of grasp the idea that they might be important. I mean, like, you know, I don't know if this is ironic or not, but I have very few pieces of my career. I recycled most of that because who cares about me? But, you know, I think that, you know, this product shows that, you know, not only did Jordan subconsciously saving this stuff lead to this really interesting interactive documentary museum piece, but also, you know, I hopefully this doesn't embarrass you or anything, but it kind of cements you as important to video game history because you saved it, you know, like there's only so many things that people can access, so much contemporary material from that time period that people can access from anybody. And I struggle to think of anyone who saved any of it. And honestly, all of it's at the Strong. It's like you and Danny Barry.
And I can thank John Romero for suggesting the Strong. And I know Doug Carlston also gave his collection, the old Bertabun collection there. So, and it was great for me because it was just getting to the point where I had so many boxes of stuff that were taking up so much space in the garage. And I was kind of wanting to downsize anyway. It was such a relief to say, okay, that stuff's out of the garage and it's going to be taken care of, you know, better than I would take care of it.
Chris, I want to go back to you because I'm still fascinated by this idea of how one does an interactive documentary. In my mind, I thought of them more as coffee table books on your screen, right? And, you know, I still feel even like this product's remarkable and does a fantastic job of doing what it sets out to do, but I kind of still feel like we've barely scratched the surface of what someone can do, you know what I mean, with like interactive objects on a screen to understand history. I mean, I don't know. Go. Like, I see you nodding.
Sure. So, I mean, No, I mean, this is, well, this, you know, this is the sort of the culmination of a lot of the, well, hopefully it's not the culmination. It's the, right. the end result. You know, it's one of the results of all the work that's been done at Digital Eclipse, you know, starting from your, you know, the beginning of your tenure there. And, you know, Digital Eclipse had been evolving, like, how do we present this extra material? Like, how do we put things in context? And, you know, a lot of it was just this idea of, like, decentering the games. Mm-hmm. Once we became, and a lot of it is, you know, working on projects where it's not a work for hire thing where the publisher is telling us, no, just do it like this. Like, don't do all this crazy stuff you're thinking about. That sounds really expensive. That sounds like it's going to take too long. You know, just do it the normal way. That's fine. So decentering the games themselves was sort of the last, like, you know, leap of faith off the cliff that we kind of had to take to say, no, we're not just going to boot up into a menu. I mean, this was one of the things that I really had to push for on Atari 50 was when the person pressed start on the title screen, you know, it does not go to a menu that says games, museum, options, because that's kiss of death. And what's going to happen is, especially for Atari games, people are going to click games and they're going to get a whole list of games and they're not going to know which one to pick. And they're going to pick one and they're not going to like it. And then they're going to try that another few times and they're not going to like the games. And they're going to decide in that moment, this is not for me. This is not my thing. I don't like these games are old.
And another thing I'll add to that, too, mm-hmm. is that even if they find a game they enjoy. So, Chris, you know this. I worked for a product called GameTap for quite a while, which was a subscription-based games on demand product from Turner Broadcasting. And we had classic and modern games. And, you know, I've always been kind of a statistics junkie in my work. And so I was poring over gameplay time and stuff like that on that product. And, you know, what we found was that everyone loaded Pac-Man once for 2 minutes and then never played Pac-Man again. And, you know, maybe like Tannel surfed some other classic games, but bounced off of them. And I actually think that people don't actually want to play old games for the most part. I think that's a very limited audience that just wants to like press start and play a very old game. Mm-hmm. I think people want to interact with the games in a way that celebrates them and, as opposed to just playing them.
And this goes, I mean, this ties into with what you were saying, a word that I use all the time, a phrase that I use all the time, of doing a disservice to these games. Because Karateka is, you know, and Jordan described it very modestly at the beginning of the call as a game where you walk to the right and punch and kick people. But like for a lot of people, it was the first game that felt like a little movie and it was incredibly influential. It sold very well. Players loved it. And it's no overstatement here to say that Karateka specifically like inspired a generation of game designers because it showed them on the screen this, you know, human character, humans acting out a movie-like story with cinematic elements. And that just inspired so many people to want to create something similar on the screen in an age of games like where the average game was something like Death Bounce, where it was something like sort of an Asteroids Plus type thing. And that's down to, I mean, it's down to Jordan. It's also Broderbund's influence. I mean, we get into that. But then the problem is if you just take Karateka for the Apple II and you give it to somebody on a GameTap type situation, you would get, well, first of all, a lot of people wouldn't even start it up because they don't necessarily, they've never heard of it.
Yep.
Right? But the people who do, they'd play it for 2 minutes. And so, Frank, what you have data that matches my feelings, which is because I'm just vibes. You know what I mean? And the vibe of playing like something, you know, an older Atari collection was very much the same thing of, oh yeah, Asteroids. And I play it for 2 minutes and that's it. So the question is, how do we harness that? And even if you only play it for a couple of minutes, make that a meaningful experience. And so with Atari 50, as you're going through these timelines, which again, to be clear, like the Atari 50 timeline design was based on the work that we had done with making of Karateka, you know, it but we were able to take that all the way to the finish line and totally finish that as a product. And you know, having a whole team on it, we could develop all kinds of new ideas and things like that. And then revisit that back onto the interactive documentaries that we were doing as indie projects. And so with Atari 50, it's like, okay, well, I played Pong for 2 minutes, but I just watched a video about the creation of Pong. I just saw the flyer for Pong. I've just read all about Pong. I know why Pong was made. I understand like why it was so important. And then playing it a little bit, that's fine. And then once I'm done with Pong 2 minutes later, I'm not kicked out to a carousel of more games and I have to go find something to do again. I'm still on my journey. I'm still in the middle of a narrative that I'm invested in, hopefully. And then when I come to the next game that I play 2 minutes of, all of those little bits of gaming, of playing old games for a little bit, they all added up to something. And the thing they added up to was a video game. And so that was sort of the feeling behind that. And so with Karateka, with the making of Karateka, if you're following along, and a lot of people do, you know, a lot of people, it's like you have to give them the controller. They have to be in control, but then you can gently guide them to the experience that you would like them to go on. And a lot of them will do that, because that feeling of being in control, you know, it's enough to know that they could always leave if they wanted to, but then you don't get to Karateka until the end of the third timeline. Yeah. And so you've played all these other games. And so hopefully by the time that you finally play it, if it was simply just given to you, you wouldn't understand how important it was, because it's kind of like playing Karateka now with no context. It's like, oh yeah, you know, it's like a video game, but it's like, but this set down the rules for what you consider to be a video game. And you have to know that.
Chris, you said before narrative, and I think that's what's so wonderful about the way you've done it, is that the product tells a story, and each game, every letter, it's because it's part of that story. I think what surprises and touches me, you know, seeing it now, is how strongly the human aspect comes out. I mean, you've got these videos, you know, with different game developers, and then, you know, my dad, you know, who composed the music for the game, you know.
Best new video game character of this year is Francis Mechner.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, at age 92, you know, remembering, you know, what we did 40 years ago. And, you know, his personality comes through so strongly. It's, I think, probably the best, you know, response, you know, the thing that makes me happiest to hear, you know, as, you know, the making of Karateka is out now and people are starting to respond, is when they say, you know, I never knew about Karateka. I don't care about it. Totally uninterested. But when I started playing this, I got engrossed and I was fascinated. You know, some people say, you know, I was born in 1991. You know, I don't know about that era, but now it tells a story that's a human story. And so that they're learning about this era that in many cases, you know, it's like long before they were born, but still there's so much in it that you can connect with in ways that have nothing to do with, you know, the pixels or the animation, but then the pixels and the animation are there too. And you've got this wonderful watch play feature so that, you know, when you come to a version of the game and you think, oh, I might want to try playing it, you can play as much or as little as you want. You can just watch the game and then you can jump in and play. So it's, you know, it's really, there's just, you can just interact with it in your own way at your own pace.
Jordan, I'm curious, you know, it must be a really unique experience being you playing through this game, playing through the making of Karateka. Because, I mean, yeah, on the one hand, you're reliving memories, but on the other, like, I'm sure there are things you've forgotten. But maybe more importantly than that, like, I have to imagine, because this happened to me at least, that there are things that are being contextualized in maybe ways that even, you know, your synapses hadn't connected on.
Oh, absolutely. No, there are things there that not only had I not seen them in 40 years or more, I'd literally forgotten that they ever existed. Yeah, there's, I think there's one game, there's like a planet Earth in it. There's a prototype. I don't remember ever programming a prototype of that game. I remembered like this sort of the piece of paper with a sketch of the way that the game was going to look, because that piece of paper kind of kicked around. You know, I'd probably seen it over the years. Oh, should I throw this out? No, I'm going to keep it. So I knew that that existed, but the fact that I must have spent a few days actually programming a prototype and getting it to animate, that there was like no neuron anywhere in my brain that remembered having done that. So it was surprising to see that.
I think for me, something that gelled that I think is the magic of, you know, maybe not, maybe it's this medium or maybe it's just filmmaking, but that, you know, I understood inherently that Karateka came from a place of Jordan, of you sort of starting your game development journey, trying to bring what you were seeing in arcades home, but then being inspired by things like Choplifter and maybe a little later things like The Castle of Dr. Creep, where you were starting to understand that, like, oh, a home game is different than an arcade game, which was, you know, a new concept at that time. And you know, Chris, in this documentary, being able to, not that I forgot what Choplifter is like, I love Choplifter, but, you know, in the context of this discussion, you know, seeing Choplifter in action and seeing the little animated guys running and like waving at the copter and everything as it's being discussed that this was, you know, sort of a new way of thinking about the medium of video games. Like that really, again, I knew all these things inherently, but that really like connected it all for me.
We had to show it, right? Yeah. We absolutely had to show, you know, the least amount of Choplifter that we felt we could get away with, basically, you know, but we had, you had to see it because it, the, and you know, it's not just, you know, when I kind of started researching this and reading the journals and looking back at everything and, you know, seeing how often, you know, Jordan's father, Francis Mechner, popped up, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like, this guy is an unsung hero of video game development, you know, not only for like making the so many suggestions. And I told him, and I you know, because we were sitting there, you know, having this conversation at the apartment, I'm like, you're, you know, you're a brilliant game designer, you know, all the other things you've done in your life. You're also like, he's because he was able to, having no experience with video games, never having played them, look at what Jordan was making and to identify an issue and say, there's a problem here. Here's a suggestion you might consider for how to deal with that. Because he was watching the characters punch and kick each other. And then he was like, I don't know what's going on. It would be really good. And this, he even said this as part of his behavioral psychology background, you know, that like, it would be good to know when a hit was definitely made. And then even talking about the life bars, the transition from solid bars to individual triangles was part of this conversation of, it would increase the tension if I knew that I only had exactly two hits left, you know, before I died. And so not only, you know, not only him, but Gene Portwood, I don't think gets talked about enough. In terms of, I mean, we talk about Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, but, you know, when you start digging into Gene's influence as a former Disney animator who came into a game studio, which in and of itself is very odd, you know.
Well, I think Gene even, like, I think Gene did those Choplifter people, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and yeah, he was the one looking at games like Choplifter and saying, look, like, let's get humans in here. Let's get a little character. Let's get that sense of the animated character, because it's gonna drive that more of a connection between the player and what they see on screen if they have a little person. And so, you know, he insists that goes in there. That goes in there. Broderbund shows it to Jordan. This inspires Jordan to do Karateka.
Gene then comes in. Lauren Elliott too.
Yes,
he and Gene worked together. They were like this pair. Like, I arrived at Broderbund in 84, and so for the first time I was at a games company. Everybody around me was making games. I wasn't the only one. And I could walk into Gene and Lauren's office. They'd be doing cool stuff. They'd be doing animations. And, you know, I could tell them what I was working on, and they would, you know, bounce stuff back. They would tell stories about their past games that they'd worked on. And then before that, animated movies. I was just drinking it up. And yeah, in Karateka, I mean, there's so much of Gene and Lauren's ideas, and as you said, like their enthusiasm for making things more human and more dramatic
Yeah, and you know, just the thought of more human, and you kind of mentioned this earlier, Jordan, that this comes across as a very human story. You know, in discussing your father's contributions, something that, you know, is sort of talked about in this product is Francis had no interest on his own in computer games, you know,
I don't think he ever played a computer game, and I don't think he has to this day.
But he was interested in you, you know, like he was interested in his son's creative pursuits, and it's, and, you know, and those game design innovations that you mentioned, Chris, are not coming from a place of like a love of the medium. It's coming from a place of a love of his son. And I just think that's kind of a remarkable thing to capture.
Yeah. You know. And he was a savvy, you know, business person himself. I mean, he left the world of academia, you know, formally to start essentially being a serial entrepreneur and opening up all these businesses and working with people. And so I think he gave a lot of that to you as well, as far as like, how do I take what it is that I'm doing and really formalize it and like, you know, like conduct myself in a business-like manner? Because he saw that, I think that you also just had that, like, I want to get started. I want to do this. I want to, you know, sell these games to people.
Yeah. Well, even that, because like at the time, 1980, 81, 82, you know, computer games were so new. Like a couple of years before that, it had been pinball. And then in 1978, it was Space Invaders. So even this model of what an arcade game was, you know, and the idea that this was something that people would put enough quarters into the machines to make it, you know, a profitable business, that was new. Most parents at the time did not see this as a viable career for their kids. I mean, as John Romero wrote in his, you know, wonderful memoir, Doom Guy, that he just released, like in his household, playing video games was actually forbidden. It wasn't just lack of parental support. It was an active, no, you may not do this. So, I mean, I was lucky that my parents, you know, were open to this and supporting me in whatever, you know, whatever I would do. But, sorry, I lost the thread there. I was going somewhere. What did we say just before that?
I think just tried to help you out and give you the tools that you needed to like make it bigger than it was.
Yeah, I mean, to take the music for an example, you know, seeing that I was trying to tell this kind of human cinematic story on screen, but that it's completely silent except for the thumps of the punches and kicks, you know, it needed music. And so just coming at it as an artwork. He said, well, can you have music? And I was like, well, no, you can't have music. It's an Apple II. Can it make sounds? Can it make beeps? I was like, well, there's the speaker, but if I toggle the speaker, I have to freeze all of the action on the screen, you know, while I'm playing the tone. But between that, we worked out a system to play notes. And then he sat down at the piano, composed the themes, and, you know, because he understood it as a story, we were able to connect kind of like almost like as a film composer would do it. He just needed to know who are the characters, what are the situations. And so then he came up with a motif, you know, for the princess, a motif for the villain, for the hero. And within the limits of the beeps and buzzes, you know, tried to weave these together into a score.
It's so interesting. I hope this doesn't make you feel old or anything, but like, you know, looking at Karateka now just reminds me of looking at early experimental cinema, right? Where it's just like, what tricks can we do with the very limited tools that we have? You know, I just watched like an experimental something from 1909, just because YouTube's great for this, last night. And, you know, it was very much like, we can reverse the film, you know, like we know how to like overlay a piece of film on top of another piece of film, and that's kind of all the tricks that we have, but we're going to juice everything we can out of this and you know, coming up with like a way to play music on the Apple too, you know, it just kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah, well, silent film was actually what I was studying at the time. In college I was taking film classes because, you know, I was always passionate about film, like even as a kid before there were computer games to be passionate about, you know, I loved movies. And so I was seeing these early silent films from like the late 1800s, the early 1900s, where they were doing things like close-ups and dissolves and in-camera effects for the first time. And that definitely fed into Karateka. And I mean, in a lot of ways, even just in the structure of the frame, because the first film cameras, like you couldn't move them. They would set up the camera on a tripod and the actors would perform the scene in front of the camera as if they were on stage, which was the previous entertainment medium. You know, like theater went into early silent film, even though they didn't have sound, but it was as if the camera were just seeing all the action in profile, as if looking at a stage. Well, that's what computer games looked like too, but it was because we didn't have 3D. We couldn't have any depth. Everything was going from left to right. So so those commonalities between the two media made me think that, you know, this really is just the beginning. You know, so limited this year by what the Apple II can do, but a few years from now, it'll be something else. And so, I mean, that was exciting to feel that I had, like, had the luck to be to be born at the right time, to be the right age, to be making early games of something that was really almost brand new. I mean, that was motivating.
Yeah. And ultimately that was really important because that you had that inspiration. You took that from films and you were right on the cutting edge of that because, you know, prior to that, you know, you had kind of been chasing what was already popular, right? And had to deal with, you know, multiple sort of rejections and that. I mean, that was one of the other things that, you know, kind of putting this together into a story. You know, I realized like this Deathbound story is not just like it's like this is such a part of the story because the rejections, you know, suffered here are what essentially led to you saying, I have to think ahead. I have to look to what's going to be popular a year or 2 years from now and start working on something like that versus something that had already been successful because things are moving so quickly.
Yeah, I think that's right. I was chasing like the games that were impressing me at that time, but by the time, you know, after the 6 months it took me to program it, the industry had moved on. I mean, I was chasing a moving target. I think Karateka was the first project that I did where it wasn't inspired primarily by other games. I mean, yeah, there was Choplifter, there was Swashbuckler, which kind of, they suggested the possibility that a game could tell a story, that a game could be, could have this sort of human narrative aspect. But as to what form that would take, you know, really the influences on Karateka were things that weren't games. You know, there were Kurosawa's movies, there were the early silent movies, with their, you know, cross-cutting, you know, and having to tell a story like with gestures without dialogue, the music. I mean, my dad's influences there, you know, Wagner and, you know, Prokofiev, you know, with the leitmotif approach. I was looking at movies. I was looking at Japanese woodblock prints. So none of these things were games. And so like, it's really hard to win the race if you're looking at what games are out there and trying to think, how can I do this better and advance it to the next step? Because there's so many other people trying to do the same thing and they're going to, you know, it's very hard to win that kind of race, but nobody else was doing the things that I was doing for Karateka just because they were so odd and idiosyncratic. I mean, just, you know, the combination of, you know, the silent film, the leitmotifs and the Japanese woodblock prints and karate. It's like, you know.
And the rotoscoping, I mean, even if people understood how you did the rotoscoping, they still weren't going to be able to copy it because it was such a time-consuming, laborious, you know, process that relied on this very fragile sort of string of technological, you know, from the Super 8 to the Moviola to the VersaWriter, you know, it's if any one piece of that failed, it just wouldn't have worked.
Yeah, I mean, how many people actually had a Moviola in their basement and how many people had a VersaWriter? I think I don't know if anybody else had both of those things.
Yeah, yeah, was a serial number on yours like 12?
I know Roberta Williams had a VersaWriter.
She did.
Only one I know for sure.
Yep.
God, I can't believe we made it almost an hour before the term rotoscope came up while talking about Karateka. That's got to be a record. So just in the time we have left, I do want to talk about, there's so many features in this product to get to, but something that I think is really cool is, I don't remember what it's called in the product, so fill it in, Chris, but Mike Micah's remastering of Karateka.
Karateka Remastered.
Karateka Remastered. Great
That's
title.
That's what it's called.
So, you know, this is something that, you know, we often talked about the idea of sanding off some of the rough edges of older titles so that they feel to a contemporary audience the way they may have felt to, well, a contemporary audience when the game came out. Jordan, I'm kind of curious about your experience seeing that. I mean, were you like, oh, this is just my game? Or were you like, oh, wow, I'm seeing like all the work that went into this?
Yeah, I feel like I'm seeing something from a parallel universe, you know, like from the 90s. It's, I mean, yeah, it's Karateka, but it's also something new. It's like, it's a port that goes far beyond the original that was never made, that maybe couldn't have been made. No, it's...
Did you have any input on the remaster?
Very, very little. I think I made just some general comments on a very early version, but from that to the final version, no, it was all Mike.
I think my favorite thing in there is I don't know, I think since reading the Jordan's journals, just for some reason we're all fascinated by this cat that didn't make it in the game. You know, like anyone who's read those journals is like, oh, the lost cat. It was we believe leopard. It was a Gene Portwood animation, right? This big,
it was
Lorne Elliott. Okay.
Yep.
And he actually did it, like he'd animated it all. He had all the frames, they were beautiful, way better than I could have animated a leopard. And this was like August. This was getting to August of 84. So I was, and I knew I had to go back to do my senior year of college in September. And so sort of all summer, I'm like, okay, I've got to be done by September. And everyone at Broderbund was like, nah, he's not going to go back. He's going to, like, he's here. For some reason, I was just determined that I was going to go back and finish college. And what that meant was that when it came down to it, I didn't have time to put the leopard in. And it broke my heart because what everyone had been saying, yeah, this is a great game, but with the leopard, it's going to be a classic. And I really believed that. It's, you know, because the villain, you know, he had his eagle, like now he had another pet who was going to be the penultimate boss. So to not put that in. Yeah. Again, it's like death bounce, delayed gratification. Finally,
the leopard's here. No, yeah. I was actually still here the day that we found those on one of the discs. I think it was Jason Cirillo at Digital Eclipse found it because we had just figured out the tools we needed to like view the sort of raw image data on the disc. And it's like, oh my God, there's the leopard. Just everyone knew about the leopard. And it was like we dug out like a mummy or something. Like this ancient artifact.
Right. Well, that happened a lot on this when we dig stuff up. I wasn't there, you know, for the leopard thing, but I mean, we dig stuff up. And I mean, even towards the end of the project with Death Bounce, the final prototype of it, once we got it implemented in the project with our rewind feature, I was like, I think that this last version of Death Bounce, I don't think it just goes infinitely. I think that, like, you know, Jordan was saying he wanted it to be like a story with an ending. So I'm going to sit here and I'm going to try to get through as many cars as I can by rewinding. And I got to car 20 and there was a final boss battle against the core. And
you were literally the first person probably to
I was
that. Yeah.
Literally the first person to see that in 40 years. And I immediately sent it to, you know, Jeremy Williams and Dave Reese who did Death Bounce Rebounded. And like they had built the core boss in that version around your notes, but they'd never seen it. They didn't think it existed. I mean, there were so many crazy things like that happened when we would kind of put things together or find something and realize what it was like. Realize what I'm looking at. And that's why it's so important to like have the journals, because you find a screenshot and you can't really figure out what the screenshot is, but then you match it up with a thing in the journal. It's like, oh my God, this is a picture of the Karateka hero committing harakiri with a knife because that was how the game was going to end if you failed. And you realized that, like, you had drawn that out. And it's only by reading the journal and looking at the floppy disk stuff that you realized what that was. And I mean, yeah, so the leopard was a part of that. And then, too, like, funny story, somebody then pointed out after the game came out and was like, hey, didn't Broderbund use that leopard in their 1986 Apple II software called Animate? And I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah, look, look on archive.org, there's a scan of a catalog and Animate, and if you look, it's the leopard. I'm like, oh, that is it. But I mean, how could we possibly have known, you know, that was it? And yeah, because it came out like 2 years later, but they repurposed it for that. The other funny story, by the way, is that my wife and I were watching a Jeopardy Masters, which is this thing where they brought back Jeopardy champions. They gave them harder questions. And one of the questions, like the $2,000 whatever question, right? It showed a series of photographs of either a cat running or an animal running, and, you know, a sequential photographs of that. And it's like, blah, 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 by this photographer. And I'm like, oh, Mooey Bridge. And my wife is like, what? And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, you know, Jordan mentioned it in his journals that Lauren Elliott's leopard animation was just, it looked like something that the photographer Mooey Bridge had done.
Yeah, and that's, I don't know, that's sort of the magic moment, right, Chris, where you know, I was fortunate enough to experience this a couple times, including on The Secret of Monkey Island, when I was working with Ron Gilbert's source code and his notes and stuff, like tying those three things together and like coming up with that aha, like, oh, that's what this, you know, indistinct piece of art is actually meant to represent. Because if I look at like this commented out part of the source, and I look at this handwritten part of this notebook, it's like, aha, I've discovered part of a lost civilization here. And
then we can bring that to people, you know, and then we can show that to people and give them, you know, that to look at and have all that context there. And so, I mean, that's, again, I really think that the making of Karateka works not only on its own, but as a proof of concept. Like, there are great stories out there. People will enjoy going through these stories, and the medium of the video game is the best and only way, you know, to tell these stories, because you have to have that interactivity and you have to have that ability to, because this is also a great digital archive of all of Jordan's papers as well, because rather than we couldn't do that with a film documentary, but we can do that here, where you can have a horizontal timeline that we have that tells you the main story. You can dig deeper into those elements by going in the vertical timelines. Then if you want to dig even deeper, we can have a gallery of 50, you know, design documents that you can go through, but we can separate it out in that way. So you're not just, again, just hit with everything. It's like, how deep do you want to go? And I bet you a lot of the people who came away thinking, hey, this is a really great story, I really enjoyed that, they might not have even looked at everything. You know, they might have even read everything at this point. So that's a vindication, I think, as well, that you put that control in people's hands, let them experience it the way that they want to experience it, and they will come away with something.
Yeah, it's what you're doing. And part of it is digital archaeology. But you're doing what archaeologists can't do, is that you're bringing it back to life so that you can actually use and play with and experience these things again.
Right.
Yeah, a museum exhibit, when you go, you know, you can spend an afternoon there, and then a week later you can go back to the same museum and look at different things and enjoy that afternoon as well.
Yeah, but to your point, Jordan, it's like with the sort of all digital archaeology, you know, it's possible sometimes to not just sort of, you know, a museum might be able to build a representation of something to put you in the correct mindset to sort of be able to visualize what something might literally have been. But there's times in digital archaeology with games where it's like, you know, I've rebuilt cut content from games into the game to be like, here's literally how it played. And that, you know, Mike kind of did something similar perhaps with the cat, although that's not coming from a place of having documented source or anything, because it never made it in. But I think that's part of the magic of doing this through games, you know, that you might literally be able to bring back, you know, a literal lost thing as opposed to just a representation, which, I mean, as I'm speaking, I'm realizing, duh, you did that with Death Bounce.
Yeah. Well, I know, and you know, Death, and then of course Death Bounce Rebounded, much like Karateka Remastered, it's all kind of in service of the story, because again, like, you know, we can bring back Death Bounce, but we can't recreate the feeling of what it would have been like to play that game in 1984, when it would have been, I think it would have been more thrilling, you know what I mean, to people that were, had grown up on arcade games. Like, they would have been a little bit more in sync with that Apple II product. But to be able to do Death Bounce Rebounded and to keep the core of what is interesting about Death Bounce, and then provide a modern control scheme, the things that people are looking for, that truly kind of takes it full circle and really brings it back. And it's like as if Broderbund had published Death Bounce in the 80s and there had been incremental Death Bounce sequels between then and now, and it had been this franchise, and like, what would it be like today?
Yeah, we're in an alternative timeline in which Death Bounce exists.
Right, yeah. Right. Death Bounce 64.
Yeah. That was the one no one talks about anymore. It was the black sheep of the Death Bounce franchise. Jordan, Chris, gosh, this is a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Video Game History Hour. Everyone listening, go check out The Making of Karateka, available on pretty much every platform at this point. Switch, PS, Switch, PlayStation, Xbox, Steam. Check out Jordan. What's the name of the book you just published?
Replay, Memoir of an Uprooted Family.
And that's available pretty much any bookseller as well.
It's actually out at the moment only in French.
Oh.
If you speak or read French, it's published under the title Replay, Memoir d'une Famille. But in March of 2024, it will be out in English. And on my website at jordanmechner.com, there's a page about Karateka and the making of Karateka. There's also a page about Replay, which shows what it is, and there's links to pre-order it and so forth.
All right, everyone, go check those out. Thanks again, both of you.
Thanks, Frank.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunamune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.